This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your numbers, 297-5633 locally and outside the Baton Rouge calling area. It's 877-217-5757. You can reach us by email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar is producing. Later in the hour, we will hear from Ray Strother, the Hall of Fame political consultant, and David Hallberg, one of the world's most acclaimed dancers. But we start with Tom Shedler, the Secretary of State, John Thomas Shedler, who is a former state senator and a man who knows elections pretty well. And, oh, by the way, we have one coming a week from Saturday as race for treasurer culminates with the runoff between Derek Edwards and John Schroeder. And Tom Shedler, unfortunately, it doesn't look like many of us will show up and vote.
No, it doesn't. However, I will tell you this at the onset that I'm a little bit pleasantly surprised because, you know, going into early voting, I had predicted on the low end about 300,000 total voters, which would be around a 10% voter turnout, and on the high side, around 350, representing roughly a 13% voter turnout. And it would certainly appear that now that we're 5 days completed in early voting with only two remaining, that I think my predictions are narrowing down more into that high side of around 350,000-360,000 voters, which would translate around 13, maybe 12, 12 and a half. So upper range of my earlier predictions now that I have 5 days under my belt. But certainly, Jim, that's all keep that in perspective. When you're trying to catch to 14% where you were in October, that's nothing to write home about.
Yeah, and there are 3 million registered voters in the state or thereabouts, and when only 300 or 360,000 show up, that's not good.
No, it's not. And it's a trend that is alarming, not only here in Louisiana, but across the country, as more and more people just are not participating in the process. And I know in a previous show we even talked about even the lack of participation on people qualifying to vote for some of these offices. So it's not a good trend, and I quite frankly don't know what's going to stop the skid. But we are probably hitting what I would call the bottom, so to speak, on a statewide, because you do have what we call that chronic super voter that votes in any election. I mean, it could be for a dog catch at PAX, but they're going to go vote. So we're probably somewhere in that range with these numbers we're seeing right now.
877-217-5757 is your number. Tom Shedler, our guest for just a bit longer, the Secretary of State for Louisiana for the last 8 years. In fact, November 22nd will mark, last 7 years, excuse me, will mark 7 years in office for Tom Shedler as the state's chief elections officer. And in the presidential election of a year ago, I think we voted as a state. I know we were higher than the national average, but about 68%.
68.7, closer to 69, I believe. But, yes, we were higher than the national average. And, you know, certainly a more representative vote. But aside from presidential elections, Jim, as you know, dismal. I mean, even gubernatorial elections last time, I believe, were right at 42%. But that's getting to be a good turnout when you start looking at things like this particular election or some of these local elections that draw roughly 20-25% or less.
It is interesting that as many people vote for president as they do. In Louisiana, there was really no doubt that Donald Trump was going to win our state, and yet he got more votes based on the large turnout and his strong showing than David Vitter and John Bel Edwards received combined.
I know. It's hard to figure sometimes, quite frankly. It's certainly not a perfect science by any means, although we're getting better and better at reading the data. And, of course, early voting does give us somewhat of a benchmark. You know, early voting usually represents about 20% of the overall vote ultimately. So once you get concluded with early voting, you can do a lot, little bit better statistical data, although the October vote now was up around 23-24% of the total. So we're going to have a good picture of what this is going to be, certainly after we close out Saturday. And even actually today, with only 1 day remaining, remember, tomorrow we have no early voting because of Veterans Day.
Okay. But those who wish to vote can do so. There are several locations for early voting. And a listener asked if the poll hours are the same as like a regular election.
No, sir. 8:30 to 6 for early voting.
8:30 to 6. And here in Baton Rouge, you can still go to the archives building, right?
That is correct, or the Register of Voters office.
All right. Well, there's some speculation that the city of New Orleans, Orleans Parish, could have 30% of the voters for this election. Is that possible?
Possible, but and I certainly thought that to be the case going in. They are doing better than the rest of the state. They're up about 8 or 9% when we look at early voting through 5 days. So they're up as a voting block. And then statewide, we're down 10%. So it's non-conclusive at this point, but I certainly believe that, you know, they registered about 18, 19% of the vote in October, which is high for where Orleans usually is. Orleans is usually only 8 to 10% of the statewide vote. Mm-hmm. They were up at 18 or 19%, and I certainly believe they will be a little bit higher than that when we conclude on November 18th.
Norman in Denham Springs. Norman, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Secretary Tom Shedler.
Good morning, Norman.
Yes, sir. He just commented about what might help the vote. In the presidential election, I would like to see the state change its approach to electoral college. If it's a winner-take-all and you don't vote for the winner, you're disenfranchised. I would like to see it done as a percentage of the electoral college go as a percentage.
Yes, and that is something, sir, just to let you know, that is not something that I dictate. That is dictated by the parties and the legislature.
There is one state, Nebraska, that goes by congressional district, and then Maine has some kind of configuration similar to that.
Yep.
But everybody else, the other 48, it's winner take all. And, of course, we've had some unusual circumstances over the last few years. But Louisiana used to be a swing state, Tom Shedler, and it doesn't look like we're going to be a swing state in a presidential election for some time.
No, unfortunately not. I mean, our population, we're not losing population, but we're not growing as quick as some other states. And, you know, if it continues on that trend, goodness, we even got a threat down the road of maybe losing another congressional seat if we're not careful.
All right. What about the concerns expressed by the president and some others that elections are fraudulent? I understand a well-known talk show host nationally yesterday was talking about election fraud being a reason why Democrats fared well this week. Is that realistic or is that bombast?
Well, this is my comment on that, and I've been consistent. Do I believe that there is some voter fraud? Yes. Okay, do I believe it's to the degree that a lot of people are touting? No. I mean, I have certainly seen the evidence of, quote, dead people or folks that are on the list that shouldn't be there that have voted, but certainly not to the magnitude of what some people may believe. And a lot of that goes back to folklore or what happened 30, 40, 50 years ago, and I speak to Louisiana on that. Certainly, the machines left something to be desired with the, it was almost like an automobile speedometer where one of the keys could get stuck. You know, we all heard the adage of the ballot boxes being thrown into the Mississippi River. If it wasn't indicative to or favorable to the candidate that some wanted to win. I mean, we've all heard those stories. But I personally think, and I think only to say this only to Louisiana, some states do a better job than others on list maintenance, registration maintenance. You know, we get a monthly report from the Department of Corrections. We get a vital records report every month. We submit that to the registers. They do their due diligence, and our list is clean. So as much as emphasis we put on registering people, we also keep our list clean. Some states do a great job with that, others don't. To the issue of President Trump, you know, he touted some 3 to 5 million voters. what he was referring to was really more the registration list. And I don't probably deny that that's possibly true, that the list nationwide could be out of sync by that amount, maybe more. Mm-hmm. But the key issue in that is there's no voter fraud unless one of those people that's deceased or shouldn't be allowed to vote actually votes or someone voted for him. That's where the fraud is committed. I always say if I'm moving from here to Atlanta, Georgia, probably the last thing I'm thinking about exiting the state line is going to tell my registered voter to take me off the voting log. I mean, that's as much as I'm going to go to the public library and cancel my library card. I'm worrying about getting my kids in school, finding a home, getting my electricity turned on, the like. So there are a lot of factors that go into that.
We do have to take a pause, and we'll be back to wrap it up with Tom Shedler after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Ali Baltazar is producing. The show is Talk Louisiana, and Ray Strother, the Hall of Fame political consultant, is on deck, and we're wrapping it up with Tom Shedler. And there is an election a week from Saturday. Early voting concludes on Saturday, and there is no early voting tomorrow, correct? Because
of that is correct.
Veterans Day.
Right, and we had added that a Friday early on to make up for that.
Now, for those, lastly, for those who believe their votes don't count, you've been on the other side as a candidate, and you have come back after finishing second in a primary to win your Senate seat and against Jim Tucker to get this seat that you have on a full-time basis. You beat him by about 8,500 votes in an election right. In which almost a million people voted. So you know what it's like, and every vote does count. It may not decide the election, but it's important for people to cast ballots.
Jim, you're absolutely correct. And you know, there's stories in history, even President of the United States, which margins are very, very slim in popular vote and the like. So every vote does count. I remember getting into the runoff with Pat Brister when I first ran for the Senate by 7 votes over my third-place finisher. As you indicated with I and Jim Tucker, I mean, less than 1.5 votes per precinct when you look at it statewide. So I'm a big believer in every vote counts. It's not a perfect science by any means, but, you know, usually losers on one side or the other are always going to make accusations, mm-hmm. but it's proving those accusations at the end of the day. And quite frankly, as far as lawsuits and issues on deciding elections in close margins when they contested, this office has a staunch record of slapping those down and winning in court because we can prove otherwise.
Yeah, I'm just looking at Tom Shedler, 1995, 6,122 votes. Alvin Singletary, 6,115.
That's right.
Yeah, if you had not gotten an additional 7 or 8 votes, we probably wouldn't be talking in this.
That is correct. I'd be home planting roses or something. Tomatoes.
Well, thank you, Tom Shedler.
All right.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, Jim. Always. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're joined now by the Hall of Fame political consultant, Ray Strother, in so many halls of fame that it's hard to keep track. But Ray Strother, as we've heard before, is a Democratic political consultant, and his party had a big day on Tuesday. Today's Wall Street Journal says Republicans have begun assessing how to prevent a potential Democratic wave in next year's midterm elections after a political shellacking fueled by opposition to President Trump. The results of elections from Virginia to Washington State produced Democratic victories up and down the ballot. Ray Strother, are you pounding your chest right now?
Yeah, I feel like those cartoon characters, bow, pound, take that. It was a great day for Democrats, and I think it foretells something we're going to see over the next year. You can't have a president that unpopular pushing issues like taxes and health care that are that unpopular and have people survive on his coattails. It can't happen. So I think we'll see a lot of changes around the country.
Now, there's always a danger of getting complacent or arrogant, and this is a, I don't think there's any doubt, it was a big day for the Democratic Party, but as you know, these things go in cycles. How long can this cycle continue for Democrats?
Well, it'll continue probably for the next 4 years. unless something happens drastically to change the popularity of the president. We can't minimize how what impact that has. I think in a previous interview, we talked about when I was doing races around the country, and we had a president, particularly in the South, where everybody was very conservative, and we had a Democratic president. People were running from the Democratic president. They would be happy to campaign, but not with the Democratic president. And when in 2010, I'm in Georgia right now today, but 2010, when Governor Barnes was running, President Obama called and said, "Roy, would it help you or hurt you if I come down? I'll do either one you say." So wow. They're pretty realistic.
Yeah, and there's an example, Roy Barnes. If John McCain had won the 2008 presidential election, Roy Barnes would have been reelected governor.
That's right. Exactly right. It would have taken racism out of it. A lot of things would have changed. And it would have changed everything. For example, the flag defeated Barnes here in Georgia. Well, I thought these Confederate monuments in Virginia would have a larger effect than they did, but turns out that wasn't the turning point for this election. The conservatives tended to want to keep the Southern monuments, the Robert E. Lee statues up, and there just weren't enough of them, both voting on just that issue. Health care and taxes and their everyday lives were more important.
Well, how much of this that happened on Tuesday, particularly in Virginia and New Jersey, states that are considered Democratic, although I think Virginia is probably more of a purple state than a blue state, but
yeah.
How much of this is just a natural tendency to go against the grain when one party has the White House, and how much is it related to dislike for President Trump?
There's some of that. But remember, this is the most unpopular president in 9-year history after 1 year. So, of course, there's a natural tendency to try to vote against the establishment. But I don't think in this case, after 1 year, that's what we're looking at. I think we're looking at some unpopular policies by an unpopular president. And people wanted this was a big turnout. You know, the off-year turnout is normally fairly low, or it can be low. And this was a large turnout, particularly among younger people. They turned out in great numbers. Women turned out in great numbers and gave women, there was a larger margin for the new Democratic governor in Virginia than there was for Hillary Clinton among women. There was a larger margin among young people. There was a larger margin among college-educated people. So across the board, the Democrats won this time.
And Virginia is a state that Hillary Clinton barely won and probably would not have won without Tim Kaine being her vice presidential nominee. And yet the candidate, Ralph Northam, who's not imbued with a lot of charisma, he slammed Ed Gillespie, who's a well-known Republican, popular former chair of the party, by a big margin. Was the margin unexpected?
Yeah, the margin was really unexpected. As a matter of fact, I ate lunch with some people in Montana, and they asked me to predict the election. I said the Democrats will win it by 3 points. Well, I was way off. It turned out about 9, I think.
Yep.
I haven't seen the final numbers, but about 9 points. So the margin is what was really surprising. There were some people really angry enough to go stand in the rain because it was raining in Virginia.
Well, and there were some unusual circumstances. A transgender candidate won. And the boyfriend of a reporter who was shot dead on live television beat a 3-term Virginia delegate incumbent backed by the NRA in a rural area. That was significant.
Well, there were at least 12, and I haven't seen the final total, but there were at least 12 changes in the legislature from Republican to Democratic, where it's going to be fairly close now. I don't know. There are some elections that have to have a recount, I understand. But the Democrats had to win 17 seats, and I think they're pretty close to it for the first time in many, many years, probably since Rob was governor. The first time in many, many years the Democrats would take control of the legislature. That shows how serious this election was.
Yeah, and it would be an amazing turnaround because going into the election In Virginia, Republicans held a 66-34 advantage in the state House over Democrats, and if these recounts turn out favorably for Democrats, it is conceivable that the Democratic Party could be in charge in Virginia.
That's right.
After being 32 seats down.
That's right. And as I said, I don't remember how long it was. I think when I was working in Virginia many, many years ago, I think Chuck Robb had the legislature was Democrat, but I'm not even sure of that. It's been a long time.
877-217-5757 or 297-5633. We'll have another segment getting the wisdom and insights from Raymond Strother, the Louisiana political consultant who went to Washington around 1980, and he certainly made a name there representing the likes of Bill Clinton, and Albert Gore, Lloyd Benson, Gary Hart. We'll be back after this timeout for the news on WRKF with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is our producer, and your number is 877-217-5757. You can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. A bit more time with Ray Strother, the Hall of Fame political consultant who is a graduate of Louisiana State University, Hall of Famer at the Manship School, as well as a political Hall of Famer in Winfield and a member of the Shrine where political consultants are honored as well. 877-217-5757. Now, Senate Republicans are under pressure to pass a tax rewrite before the end of the year, and they're expected to unveil legislation today that would eliminate the ability of people to deduct state and local taxes, but would stop short of fully repealing the estate tax. This is from the New York Times today. And this negotiation, Ray Strother, suddenly takes a new dimension after the results on Tuesday. Lawmakers always look at the elections because that's how they survive. How will the Trump agenda be affected by the election returns on Tuesday?
There'll be a huge change. The ripple effect of this will ripple into health care and taxes. There was some question already about whether the House tax plan would work because the Senate seems to have different ideas completely. But this would deal them a real blow. Political insecurity, I've been around it a long time. Political insecurity is a frightening thing to see. And there will be people trying to guard their flanks now that they see they are vulnerable, particularly a lot of people in the House of Representatives and the Senate, I guess.
But in Louisiana, it would seem doubtful that the Republican delegation, and every member is a Republican with the exception of Cedric Richmond, it would be doubtful that the GOP delegation will be bucking the president at this point. I think he is probably still considered formidable enough in our state that if you're a Republican, there would be hell to pay to go against him.
Well, I think that's true in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, maybe Arkansas, some parts of Texas. So, no, I don't think you'll see major changes in hardcore conservative states like where you are right now. But remember, these what you call purple states and purple districts around the country, districts that Hillary Clinton won and are occupied by Republicans, are all in danger. They're all in danger at this moment. And people are seeing the sign of this Virginia election is something in their own futures. So it'll be very interesting.
877-217-5757 or talk@talklouisiana.org. And an email from a listener about the 2019 governor's election in Louisiana, listening to what you were saying about what happened in Georgia. Will President Trump campaign in 2019? It's too early to tell, but would it be wise for him to campaign on behalf of a Republican challenger to John Bel Edwards?
Well, he hates to lose. The president hates to lose above all things, obviously, more than anyone I've ever seen. And to come into a state like Louisiana where he is popular, but to oppose a popular governor would probably do him no good at all. So I would be surprised if he got involved with anything more than telephone banks and direct mail in this next election, because from what I can see from far, far away, because I don't live in Louisiana anymore, but what I can see from far, far away, Edwards is still very popular.
He is, but if he draws John Kennedy as his opponent, Kennedy would be a formidable candidate, and it looks like he wants to run, Senator Kennedy does. He just got elected to the Senate last year, Ray Strother, and something about being governor of Louisiana is quite appealing. Any boy who grew up here, or girl, would like to be governor for some reason. I wonder why.
Well, you know, it's the most powerful governorship in America, I think. That's the one thing that surprised me when I started doing business in other states, how people in other states would think that they'd rather be in the Senate than hold the governor's chair. And Louisiana is an exception to that because the governor has so much power and lives so well that being governor in Louisiana is better than being governor in almost any state. Remember, and the governor of Connecticut, when I represented him, Bill O'Neill, they had a cook that got off at 5 o'clock. Uh-huh. And he drove his own car to the Capitol. That isn't the case in Louisiana. So being governor of Louisiana is a fine thing to be. In America particularly, you have to be almost an Arab prince to be treated as well as a governor.
Well, and you speak as a man who actually lived in the governor's mansion for a while.
That's true. I certainly did. And I loved, you know, all the services, having the cookies and milk by my bed every night and everything. That was just fine.
I bet it was pretty good stuff. But that election is 2 years away, and in Louisiana, obviously, but a year from now, we'll already have the race well underway. And John Bel Edwards is an aberration in our state and in the South as a Democratic governor in the Deep South. Some are touting him as a national timber. What do you think about the Democrats' depth of bench going into 2020? Who would likely be the candidate to oppose President Trump?
You know, this is a strange thing to say because of the age factor, but I think Biden's our natural choice in this thing. And if he should run, he would be a formidable opponent for Trump, a formidable opponent. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised to see him emerge. He would certainly be my candidate at the moment. There may mm-hmm. be somebody else out there, but I think Biden would be a great Democratic candidate.
I think he's running, and he has run before. He ran against your candidate, Gary Hart, many moons ago.
He did.
But he was born in 1942, which means he'll be 75 in next month. Next month he turns 75. It means 2 years from now he'll be 77. Now Donald Trump will be 73. In the old days, those guys would have been considered, my God, we can't elect somebody who's a septuagenarian, and in Biden's case, closer to 80 than 70, but he seems to be a vigorous man.
It'll still be a factor, but I think Reagan broke that barrier, because Reagan was an older president. I think people, after Reagan, changed their minds a little bit. Also, we're living longer now. We all know people in their 90s now. It's not unusual. So I think age is still a problem, but I think he could overcome that.
All right. Another listener, Tracy, asks about the Donna Brazile dust-up this week. Her book is generating some concern in Democratic quarters. What do you think of her statements about Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party during the election process of a year ago?
Well, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. But one thing I feel about is, I think the Democratic Party in Washington has too much power, personally. I think it should be more delegated to the states, the power. And I think that somehow that what parties do really doesn't matter. I mean, within the party, within the Democratic Party, that's their business. That's their own politics. It doesn't affect anything else. And I hate this happened, but I don't think that it's going to affect the Democratic Party particularly, except I've watched through the years the Democratic Party become more and more powerful in Washington and the Republican Party, and it's all because of money, because they were able to raise huge amounts of money. I'd rather see it go back to the way it was in 1980, where they were advisors but not rulers of the people running for office in other states. I think the people in the states know better how to run their own races. And when the National Party gets involved, poor old political consultants like me, sometimes they get very difficult because they would bring in ideas that just didn't belong in that state.
Another inquiry about the tragedy in Texas, 26 people killed at a church on Sunday. Will this spark any new debate on gun safety or gun regulation?
No.
No.
If you can kill a lot of children in Newtown, Connecticut, and not have legislation passed, it won't work here either. I don't think you'll have any. I don't think anything will change. And I don't think the gun debate will be a major issue.
And we have a lot of rancor in politics. In a way, we always have. People used to shoot each other. But Ray Strother, another listener, notes about this wild fracas with Rand Paul and his next-door neighbor, two doctors duking it out, and Paul's in serious condition. What's going on in our country right now?
Well, there's always been a lot of anger. I know in a couple of campaigns, I've had to have bodyguards at the end of it, and in this country, too, not of course, you American consultants have to have bodyguards often when you work outside the country. In this country, a couple of times, I've had to have bodyguards. There's always been a lot of violence. But I think that seems to be a dispute between two neighbors and lawn clippings, as I can understand it.
What was it Tip O'Neill said? All politics is local? Well, this is a perfect example. But
I don't think that was about politics. I think that was about something else.
Well, I hear this other guy was a Sanders supporter, so Rand Paul might have gotten on his last nerve. But a 59-year-old doctor and a 54-year-old doctor who's a U.S. senator getting into it in, I presume, a very nice neighborhood over lawn clippings, that takes the cake.
Yeah, I saw an aerial view, and their houses so far apart you'd have to jog 200 or 300 yards to be able to knock someone off a lawn tractor.
Well, Rand Paul ran for president last year, and he didn't do that well. But I recall when he was the hot candidate early on. People thought he might be the one to gain momentum. But as it turned out, the only one with any momentum, any mojo in the Republican ranks a year ago was the guy who won, Donald John Trump.
That's right, and he was the person that we least expected to win. You know, Paul's father also was a formidable candidate one time among libertarians. And he seemed to have picked up the mantle of his father. But he may be a little too far out for most Americans.
Yeah, Ron Paul was a guy who ran for president as well. And got a lot of support among libertarians. And when we return, we'll ask Ray Strother about whether there is room for a third-party movement in this country, or are we going to have a continuing impact created by the two major parties? Do they have a monopoly on national elections and, in many cases, local elections? 877-217-5757. We're back in a few minutes with more Talk Louisiana right here on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Easter. Thank you for being with us. We're finishing up with Ray Strother, and on deck is David Hallberg, the fabulous dancer who has written a compelling book about his life, Dancing to the Edge and Back, a body of work from David, and we'll talk with him in just a moment. Before we part company with the Hall of Fame political consultant Ray Strother, a good question from Tim Slack. He writes, can the Democratic Party be a national party, Ray, when the leadership is dominated by what he terms coastal elites, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer? Your thoughts?
I think the party has to make a lot of adjustments. Somehow we're losing the mantle of being the party of working people. And that's a great shame, because if you look at what's going on right now in tax reform and health reform, et cetera, it's the working people who are going to suffer most. And for us to lose them is a disgrace. And we are considered an elitist party. We have begun to look down on certain elements in society, and that's bad. That's wrong. It's awful. So I'm concerned about that. I don't want to see a party that runs big in California and Maine and Massachusetts and the District of Columbia, but runs badly in Louisiana and Arkansas and Mississippi. That disheartens me a great deal.
Thank you, Ray Strother. It's always fun to talk with you.
Thanks, Jim.
See you soon. David Hallberg is with us, the first American to join the famed Bolshoi Ballet as principal dancer and the dazzling artist that the New Yorker described as the most exciting male ballet dancer in the Western world. He is here talking about his book. He presents a journey through his artistic life up to the moment he returns to the stage after a devastating injury, almost cost him his career. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Jim.
It's nice to talk with you. And let's start with your life. You got into dancing, as some would suspect, quite early in life.
Yeah, at 8 years old, I saw Fred Astaire gliding across the TV screen, and I was just totally enthralled with what he was doing. I had no idea what he was doing, but I knew that I wanted to do exactly what he was doing on the TV screen. So I taped nickels on the bottoms of my penny loafers, and I impersonated a tap dancer for about 6 months, and then my parents bought me my first pair of tap shoes.
Well, people of a certain vintage who are not exposed to Fred Astaire probably don't appreciate how good he was.
Very true. All you have to do is go on YouTube and you'll see.
Well, you got into this at 8 years old, and then you trained at the Ballet Arizona School. You had a pretty good teacher, didn't you?
Fabulous teacher. You know, my parents and I didn't know a good teacher from a bad teacher. And, you know, the stars aligned, really, when we found my teacher, Mr. Hahn. And we studied very, very intensely for 4 years. And he was like a drill sergeant, very strict. And, you know, my parents and I just had complete trust in him. We let him completely shape who I became and who I still am as a professional dancer.
And then in the late 90s, you went off to Paris for a while.
I did. I went to Paris for a year, for my senior year of high school, and, you know, I was totally naive. I had never left America, and it was a very, very hard year. But, you know, it shaped me, again, who I was. I persevered through a very difficult year. I had no friends. The school sort of ignored me, treated me like a dumb American. And, you know, it was that year that I just really, really kind of came into myself. It was a true kind of coming-of-age year for me.
The guest is David Hallberg. His book is A Body of Work, Dancing to the Edge and Back. And now with a new Cold War of sorts going on with Russia, you became the first American to become a principal dancer with the Bolshoi Ballet about 6 years ago. How was that experience?
You know, it scared me to death. I was, the offer was made for me to go, and I went because I was just so attracted to the unknown of it all. I had no example. No one had really done this before. And it was a time when, you know, Bolshoi was reopening a huge renovation of their theater, and I was invited to reopen the theater in front of the president and the whole nine yards. And it was an amazingly formative experience because I took a complete risk, and again, I didn't know anyone. I didn't speak the language, and it just caused me to grow even more as a person and as an artist.
How are American performers treated abroad?
You know, it's funny. I like to dispel all of the preconceived notions that I had and that other people seem to have as well. The Russians that I encountered were so warm and open to me being there. They were so accommodating, and they really just extended a warm hand and said, you know, welcome. And, you know, obviously the pressure was on for me. I had to dance well. But every Russian I came across at Bolshoi Theater was just really, really happy to have me there. I could really feel a warmth from everybody.
Well, at the peak of your abilities, you have an agonizing retreat because of injuries. What happened?
Well, I was burning the candle on both ends is an understatement. And my left foot just started to feel, at first it felt like a bit of an itch, and then it felt like a needle and then a knife. And over the course of about 9 months, at the end of that, I could barely take off for a jump without excruciating pain. So I decided to have surgery, was very positive, a six-month recovery. And a year later, I was having a second surgery to fix the first because it had failed completely. And it was through the course of that time that I just had so many complications, and I really lost focus and will to push on. It was just riddled with disappointment. And then I retreated to Australia to an amazing rehabilitation team in Melbourne, and I bought a one-way ticket and completely disappeared. And it was there that I rebuilt my whole instrument back up, and obviously mentally and emotionally as well. And I have to say, they saved my life. They saved my artistic life, but also saved my life in general.
Yeah, well, so much of your life is wrapped up in what you do, and when that is taken away from you, it is a tough circumstance, and I suspect there were times when you thought, I'll never come back.
Oh, I thought that for a year and a half. I started to, there was a huge fork in the road before I went to Australia. It was either retire and, you know, go on to helping lead the dance world, or give it one last shot in Australia. And obviously, I gave it one last shot. And the book became about that. It became about the grit and the focus that it took to really fight my way back. It wasn't just an injury. You know, it consumed my entire life, and it was a six-month recovery. And lo and behold, when all was said and done, I was returning to the stage 2.5 years later. So the book really is all about grit and determination of focus.
People probably don't appreciate how athletic dancers have to be. Perhaps the greatest athletes in the world are on stage, and you do take a beating over time, back injuries, neck injuries, and in your case, a foot injury. These things are not all that uncommon, are they?
No, they're not. I mean, injury is an inevitability in an athlete's career, in any athlete's career. And what I learned in Australia was dancers condition just like athletes. So I like to make the connection that I am same part artist, same part athlete, because you'll see the conditioning routine that I go through daily. I mean, I was just doing a set of abdominals before we got on the phone, and the conditioning routine daily is so important, and it's so rigorous, and it's on par to football players and tennis players and whatever sport, you know, you may watch.
Well, how is it having to into hell and back to be back on top?
Listen, you know, I'm at a point where I don't know if I were to push rewind, if I would go through the experience again or not, because I learned so much about myself. And, you know, that message is in the book. It's about me going through this experience and reorganizing my entire life, being more grateful. I'm more grateful in life and on stage, and I feel just more grounded as a person, which everyone, you know, it's great to be in the spotlight, but you have to be a good person as well, I think.
Well, lastly, you've been described as the most exciting male ballet dancer in the Western world. I'm sure you may wince and smile at the same time when you hear people say that.
I do. You know, the beauty of art is it's subjective. I mean, you know, you can choose a dancer that you really like to follow, and then another dancer that you don't. And same goes for a musician. You know, you can love Beyonce but not like Lady Gaga.
Well, David Hallberg has told his story in amazing detail, and it is quite a story of an exceptional American performer, a body of work, Dancing to the Edge and Back. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too, and congratulations. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.